So far we know where Rabbi Akiva stands, but the question is, in my mind, in all honesty, how come they say that this represents Rabbi Akiva's opinion that, you know, if you uproot it, well, I suppose, I mean, from the point of view that you're destroying it, okay, so that would be it.
You're destroying the plant.
You're destroying it.
Okay.
Whereas if you keep it up, right, then in that particular case, you deserve Malkus for it, right?
Oh, you deserve Malkus?
You deserve Malkus if you keep it, not for destroying
it. Destroy it.
Right.
Destroy it,
okay. Right, right. Right. Okay. Now, what is the attitude of the Jewish worker? This is really what Rashi is pointing out. Rashi is pointing out that the problem over here is, does the Jewish worker want the kilayim to stay, because the more kilayim that is around,
the more
he'll do business.
Does he get paid for that?
Of course he's getting paid for that. Otherwise, why would there be a parallel to the other question,
right.
You know?
Why would the non-Jew care if there are kalayim?
The non-Jew doesn't care if there are kalayim, but can the Jew have any kind of hanor from it, even though it doesn't belong to him, it belongs to the non-Jew, you understand? Because he's getting paid for doing work with kilayim. So that's why it says, Ein Odrin, you're not allowed to hoe over there, because if he does something that would, you know, make the soil even better and enable these plants to thrive, then in that particular case, he's definitely violating what Jewish law tells him as a Jew to do, you understand? But to destroy it, okay, so he can get paid for doing that based on the parallel of the other case. However, there's also the mental attitude, as we say, that you have to consider.
Double-edged sword.
Right. If he enjoys the fact that there are kilayim over there and he'd like to see more of it so they could do, he could earn more money or something like that, then in that case, is it right, you see?
So, another
job. Right.
How can you know what a man is thinking?
Yeah.
How can you punish
him? I like the idea where he was mixing principle and profit. That seems like a very good idea.
Yeah. You're right. You can't punish him for what he's thinking. You're right.
Can't do what?
You can't punish a person for what he's thinking. I mean, you punish him for actions, but not
right,
the thinking. Right.
Right. So you can't tell what he's doing it, whether he's doing it with selfish motives or not.
Right.
The fact is, as long as he does destroy it,
right,
he's okay.
Yeah,
right.
But on the other hand, he could say that he shouldn't take this kind of work unless it was like a contract that says that he was paid to destroy everything.
Oh, right, right.
And then the person who's paying him looks and sees that there's nothing left, and then he gets paid. Not rather than you work for 3 hours moving the dirt.
I actually don't see the problem with that when you say that. Is it problematic that he may wish to see the kilayim grow so that he can get paid for destroying it, because his intention is not to have it grow, his intention is to destroy it. He's hired
to destroy.
Okay, but his intention
what do you know what his intention is? His intention may be that they would like to have more work to do.
Well, yes, I understand,
okay.
But his intention is only that he prospers only by destroying it. So his intention always is to destroy it.
Yeah, but habakayim, right? In other words, to keep it in existence, right?
Is a sin.
That's a sin.
Oh, in other words, if he doesn't take them all so that they can flourish a little more, so the next time he comes, he can fix them all. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Anything that he does in order to.
If he ignores something, and it will of itself grow,
yeah,
then he has in a way.
But ultimately, again, it comes down to, can you derive benefit, you know, from something which is a violation of the Torah law? Torah says you're not allowed to have kilayim, right? It says actually, no, it's Israel, right? You're not allowed to plant, but will see that it's not just planting, it's also, you know, to keep it going and so on, right, cultivating it and so on, right. Right. Yeah. Right. All right. So that's the question.
The question is: is he working on piece work or is he working on time, but on a time basis?
Yeah. Well, either way.
Well, you know, it's
I understand, but even so, I mean, it's going to wind up the same way in any case, right?
Either way,
he still wants to get paid for whatever work he's doing over there. Okay. All right.
Right.
Now, how do we know this? This is Rabbi Akiva's opinion. This is a question. Besides the fact that we said that, you know, that Hamakayim Mikilayim Lokim, says the Tanya. Because we have Gemara, which says Hamadake, Shabachape, and so on. Okay, actually, it's yeah. So what is Benakish? Benakish means that you pull out you weed it out, okay? Or hamechape, mechape. You recognize the word chope over there. What's a chope? It's a covering. I mean, that's the original meaning of the word chope, right? So hamechape, in other words, he covers over the kilayim, in order to, you know, he puts soil on them in order so that they should grow better, or something like that. So whether he's weeding or putting soil over them, right? Loke, right? He receives malchus as his punishment for that. Rabbi Akiva Omer Af HaMekayim. And Rabbi Akiva says, even one who keeps it, who preserves the kelayim. Now, what does it mean, Af HaMekayim? So we have to assume what it means is that he's not even doing anything physical. Before we mentioned a couple of physical activities that he was doing, right? Now, even if he does nothing at all, but he simply is content, you know, to let it there remain in existence. So for that also he deserves malchus, right? My Talmud, Rabbi Akiva.
Right.
What is the reasoning for Rabbi Akiva? So Amakror. So this is how he interprets a pasuk in the Torah. Pasuk says, Sodacha lo sizra kilayim, right? Which means literally, your field, you should not, you shouldn't sow seeds, right, that are kilayim. So, ein li ela zoreya. How do we know that this applies not just to the someone, you know, who sows the seeds? Mekayim and nayin. How do we know that if you just encourage it to remain in existence, that that's also a violation? Talmud Leimar, lo kilayim. What is lo kilayim? Take a look at the pasuk. Lo sizra kilayim. The fact is what? Forget about the sizra. Take that word out. What do you still have? Lo kilayim.
Right.
There shouldn't be any kilayim. Period. So that's what he means by af habakayim. Even if you just let it alone and permit it to grow, it's also a violation. Okay? And since they're quoting Rabbi Akiva for that, so we assume then that he was the one who said at the top of the page, right, that he's allowed to get pay for what?
Uprooting.
For uprooting. Because that's an action which is A, not helping the kilayim, and at the same time it's not keeping the kilayim in existence by destroying. So far so good, right?
It's operative today too. We don't know what kilayim is.
We don't know. I mean, look, it's obviously we're not out there doing the work. The one area in which it would affect us would be if we have a garden. What should we do with a garden? I mean, how should we plant various plants in the garden? Plant them all together in the hodgepodge is not right. That would be a violation. So we have to separate them. Here you put this, here you put that, and so on and so forth. And it's better if you have like a little furrow or something or other in between, something in order to, you know, try to distance them also if you can, you know, so that the roots don't grow together eventually or something like that. So in that way we can ourselves, you know, try to avoid Goliath.
Does it also affect the carnal?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you about that.
Should we also be avoiding a product that is grown from the seed?
Yeah, we should, but do we know? I mean, in today's economy, we have no idea. So all that we can say is we go according to the majority. Majority of fruit that's grown is grown separately, they're not grown together, you know, a hodgepodge or something like that, obviously. So you have to rely upon that, right? That's the way things are today. You have to rely upon the rove, upon the majority, what happens. Since we can't trace what we have.
Look at all the problems they have in trying to trace, with all the science that they have trying to trace the origin of these things. Right. Culture came to try to trace a question like Kalayim, where these seeds are grown.
Yeah, right. That's no question. It's a problem that could exist, but we don't know about it. And what we don't know in this particular case, we have to assume that since the majority is not like that, you know, it's grown commercially different than that. So that's what we have to assume. Okay. All right, so Loki Lion. Right. Now, however, if we say that, you know, we can lessen the amount of abominations that exist, in this case the kilayim, just as before the word tiflo is applied to what? To the yainesef, right? So in that particular case, it would be permissible. So they say, lo, why do you assume this Rabbi Akiva? Homani? Who could it be if it's not Rabbi Akiva? So the answer is Rabbanan he. It's the rabbis in general. So they say, maybe not. E Rabbanan, right? If you say it's the rabbis, so he says, my Yiria Okrid, if you look at your mean Nami, Shapidomi. Say, if it's the opinion of the rabbis, then there's no question about uprooting, right? But even to permit it to remain would also be okay. Why? Because if we say there are two opinions, two different opinions, if Rabbi Akiva says that Hamikayim Loike, right, the one who keeps it in existence reserves Malkus, and the rabbis don't say anything, so they must then be thinking that it's okay to keep it around.
No.
Yeah.
So they don't agree with you if they don't say anything?
Did you see them objecting to Rabbi Akiva's opinion so far?
No.
Okay. So this is how the argument has to go right now. Not sure, we're going to knock down the argument.
Well, it's just they're saying there's not a positive requirement to get rid of something that's in the
right. In other
we
words,
we don't have to like it, but we don't have to positively do something about it.
Yeah.
Because in getting rid of it, you get money for it, so you may desire. Is that correct? So you may desire stuff to exist.
Right.
Because if it exists, then you have a job.
Yeah, well, this is it's correct. This is what we've been saying so far in order to justify the guy getting paid, right?
So the conscience has to be clear.
Right. So that's the case, then maybe it's the rabbis who approve of it. I mean, that may be it, right? You know, we have different actions, right? You have positive commandments, right, that you have to do them. We have negative commandments that you must not do those things, right? But how about a positive commandment in which you do nothing? You understand what I'm saying? There are things where you just don't do anything, period. you should do something that is positive. You're not violating it by not doing it, but at the same time, you're not doing the positive thing that you should be doing. So,
I'm saying,
so give an example.
By not doing.
Can you give an example?
Okay. All right. Give an extreme example. Torah says that we have to recite Shema Yisrael every morning and every evening, right? Shach Bechov Kebecha, right? Every evening, every morning, got it. Okay. So, recite Shema Yisrael. So, God's mind. What if a person goes to sleep, never recites the Shema in the evening? Then what?
Say it twice in the morning, is that
the point? Well, I'm not discussing that right now. But the question is, what is, it's okay, it's a possibility, I don't say no, but is the punishment the same for failing to do something affirmative as it would be for doing something which the Torah tells us is negative? You understand? No.
So saying that Shema is a positive thing?
Of course.
Okay, so what's the negative thing?
Something like mooks. Things that mooks are like touching money.
For example,
money.
If you ate pork. That's doing something that's negative.
Right.
So you're punished for that. Now you're supposed to say the Shema, but you don't. Is there the same punishment or is it a lesser punishment?
Yeah, right.
Because it's just an omission rather than.
It's an omission, exactly.
Yeah.
We have a form of punishment which is called kores.
Yeah.
So severe punishment means literally the soul shall be cut off. This is the expression of Nichristo Hanefesh Hahi, right? So this of course is not done by the human court, but it's done by whom? By the heavenly court, okay? They're the ones who inflict this punishment, okay? So with Kores? Right. Kores normally applies only, right, it applies only to negative commandments. Okay?
Kores are only negative.
Right. However, there are two affirmative commandments in the Torah where it says if you fail to do it, then the punishment would be Kores.
Two.
Yeah. Only two.
Two what?
But
two negative
commandments.
Two affirmative commandments. No. No.
Oh, gosh.
Is it part of Shabbat?
No.
Shabbat?
No. No. No.
Oh, I think it is Pesach, if you don't.
Yeah, correct.
Pesach.
What? Korban Pesach is what?
Right.
Right.
Korban Pesach.
Right. Korban Pesach.
You have to eat it before midnight.
You have to eat it before midnight already. The rabbis decided that, right? But the point is to eat the Korban Pesach. This is
the
perfect commandment, and if you fail to do it, then that particular case you get Kores, right?
What's the other one?
The other one is Bris Milah.
Bris Milah.
Right, right. Yeah.
If you don't circumcise it.
Right.
Boy.
If you fail to circumcise, I'm not talking under what circumstances.
Right.
Obviously, there are medical reasons at times, and so on. But as a normal rule, child is normal. And you're the father. It's your responsibility, to have your son circumcised.
Is that a rabbinic decree? Is that a rabbinic decree?
No, Torah.
It says so.
Yeah.
In Torah.
Yeah.
But the Kuach Nefesh
overrides all. Kuach Nefesh is a different story. I'm not talking about that.
Are you saying a Bris Milah in a timely fashion or a Bris Milah at all?
Bris Milah at all. Right. A timely fashion, obviously, a child has to be healthy in order to do it on the eighth day. Okay? If the child is not healthy, you postpone it until the child becomes healthy enough in order to proceed. My son David had jaundice when he was born. We had to wait until the doctor determined, you know, that he was out of danger.
Right. But I don't. Technically, if we don't eat the Korban Pesach,
Korban Pesach can only be slaughtered in Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash itself.
We say Zecher Mikdash.
You know, like eating the sandwich, you know, with the matzah and the mor in between, right?
Yeah, right.
Hillel sandwich.
Make me hungry.
But, you know, that's an affirmative commandment. We can't do it today because we don't have it, so we're not guilty of it. But if we actually had the Beis HaMikdash in existence, then it would be a mitzvah for us to go.
In the Torah, you don't do it. Those are the only two.
Also for,
so, you know, it goes back to what I said before. We have lots of affirmative commandments, but what if you don't fulfill them? You don't get chorus if you don't fulfill them.
No, of course not.
Certainly you don't get the punishment of chorus for not fulfilling any deals. Right. Okay. So maybe it's the rabbis then, right? Okay. So they say, what kind of a case are we talking about over here? It says, Kegon deka ovid bechinam. In other words, they're not really saying that it's okay to keep the Kalayim in existence. You understand? They're not really saying that. They probably would be in agreement with Rabbi Akiva on that score. But what is the special circumstance in this particular case? This is what they're saying. Okay? So what is the special case over here? That perhaps the man was working for free of charge, for chinam. He didn't accept any wages for it. Well, in that case, then what is happening? He's doing something to help the guy, but he's destroying and not keeping it, right? What's the problem that, you know, he's not getting paid for it? It says, for Rabbi Yehuda, he says, this would be in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, the Omar, who said, Lipen lahem matnas chidam osur. This actually was, we found it in the first chapter. First chapter.
You can't give anything free.
Oh. Because it's written, of course, in the case of an idolater. I'm talking not idolater now. I'm not talking about a non-Jew. But I'm talking about an idolater. Okay? An idolater, it says, it's written in the Torah. I don't know if you remember. You know, right after it says you're not allowed to give your daughters in marriage to them, right? Or you're not allowed to let your sons marry their daughters and things like that and so on. And then it says, V'lo sechonim. V'lo sechonim. And I gave a couple of interpretations as what lo sechonim means. One of them is, you know, that lo sechonim, don't praise them for certain things. Don't say that idolatry, oh, it's so beautiful, it's a shame that we can't observe it, or something like that. That's Leisachonim. Don't give them, don't say that they're full of chayim, Leisachonim. That's how they interpret it. But the word Sechonim also is like the word chinam, free of charge. I mean, even the word chinam itself, actually, you can see this association between, free and, favor, grace, right? Chen, you understand? Yeah. So, that being the case, another interpretation of los chodeim is that you know, you're not to give them, according to Rav Yehuda's opinion, right? Do not give them any gifts. Los chodeim. Don't give them a gift. Los chodeim.
Volunteering is a sense of giving them free labor.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
In other words, what we're talking about here is that he maintains the kalayim.
Right.
In charge.
Yeah. Well, he's actually working at, but even to destroy them. But he's not accepting any money for it. He's doing it as a favor to the other guy. So in that case, you can't say, if he's not getting paid, right, he's doing it as a favor. So maybe it's not so gefilah of what he's doing, right? He's doing it out of kindness of his heart. But according to Rabbi Yehuda, it's not right. He shouldn't be doing that.
Even though he's doing the mitzvah.
Right.
But listen, that's a contradiction there.
The mitzvah is getting rid of it?
Right, he's getting rid of it.
Well, this is how we're going to say. All right, so we're jumping ahead by a line or so, okay?
Yeah.
So, as I say, Midr Rabbi Yehuda, all right, if we follow this opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that we just mentioned, then in that particular case, let's see, Nishma the Rabbi Akiva, right? And in that particular case, why don't we listen to what Rabbi Akiva had to say? Lavamar Rabbi Yehuda Osru Litein Lahem Matnas Chinam. Didn't Rabbi Yehuda say you're not allowed to give them any free gift? Of all, the miyute tifla, in order to lessen the abomination, then in that case, shapir domi. Then in that case, that's fine. That's okay. That's okay. Before we're talking about pay, now we're saying even the matnas chinam is also permitted for him to accept to do if he worked even, you know, for nothing, just as a favor.
Okay.
As long as he's destroying it, he's getting rid of it. Right? This is what they're saying. Right? To lessen the amount of abomination, and that's all right. So they say that's the case. The Rabbi Akiva Dami. Well, that's fine. So then that's okay also for Rabbi Akiva. Afal Gav, the other Rabbi Akiva, Habekayim, Yikilayim, Loike, even though Rabbi Akiva said that if you keep kilayim in existence, you get malchus, but leyute tifla, in order to lessen the amount of abomination, shapir don, then that's okay. Vesulo, and that's it. Let's not talk about it anymore. Vesulo meaning, no more. Okay, good stuff. All right, I got a question. Okay, so tonight is the 27th of June, the year 2007, and we continue now in the middle of Avodah Zarah, Samach Dalet, approximately one third of the way down, Omed Aleph. Okay, in other words, 64a, approximately about a third of the way down in the text. Okay, so it says, Hodu Yasmi. So again, the rabbis were sitting around schmoozing, right, discussing halacha and so on. Come by the who, and the question came up to them: Demei avedus kechovim biyad avid kechovim mahu. The money that an idolater gets for, let's say, selling his idol, right, and he has that money. How about that money? Of course, the question is, you know, originally we learned that what? If a Jew sells an idol, can he keep the money or something like that, right? Is he getting hanor from idolatry? In that case, of course, it's prohibited. But what about a goy sells his idol, right? Is that money is it treif or is it right? This is the question. You understand? This is the question. Is the money treif or not? Right.
In other words, the goy sells an item, he gets money for it. Then right. He pays the Jew money
for whatever, for something else. Right, yeah.
Is the money
right. Is that money kosher or is it treif? Right.
Is it tainted?
Right, exactly.
Hard to find kosher money.
Yeah, you're going to have
right.
A K on it.
Unfortunately, we know that there's such thing as money laundering and so on and so forth. I mean, we know that. I mean,
but
it goes on.
The man
right.
Knows that the money he's giving him was in.
He really wouldn't know, but it's a theoretical question. It's a theoretical question.
Oh, it's a rhetorical.
Okay. I didn't say rhetorical. I said theoretical.
No, theoretical.
Because obviously it's going to lead to another question.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Theoretical.
All right, as I say, they're mishmuzik, right? They're talking halacha, all right? And the question came up, okay. So, the question is, okay, mi tofeses domecha miyadevit kechovim o lo? In other words, does the money, you know, have validity as far as the goy is concerned or not? If he wants to, so we said, you know, let's say, do business with a Jew afterwards or something like that, can he use that kind of money for it? This
and
is the question.
The money?
Right.
The goy.
The goy. The goy. The goy.
What if the other's money is all mixed up? He's got a pile of money. He's got it from selling figs and stuff.
Yeah, right. And selling idols.
Together.
Okay, right. So that's
so
the question. Okay.
All right, go ahead.
So anyway, okay.
A little patience.
Okay. So Rav Nachman said to them, Mistabra, the Me'a Venus Kechavim, Me'a David Kechavim, Mitorin. He says, okay, look, it makes sense, he says, right? That money that a guy gets from idolatry is permitted. After all, it's his money and so on, right?
Do we have a brayer?
It's weird. So they say, yeah, but how about the following case? Okay, midahanhu the also the kame the rabba babu says, the maysa about some people who came before rabba babu, and omaluhu and he said to them, zilu zabinu komad isnehu vesu isgayru. All right, so who were these people? These people were people who wanted to become converted to Yiddishkeit, okay? They wanted to become Geritzedek.
These
okay.
Are idol worshippers who want to become converted.
Right, they want to become converted to Yiddishkeit. Now, so what did Rabbi Baruch tell them to do? He says, you know what? Go out, he says, sell whatever you have. Meaning, of course, you know, whatever idols or anything like that you have, go sell it. Right, and then come back, and I'll make you into Jews. Okay. My Tamu, for what reason did he give them that advice? He says, "Mishum de Kosovo," because he was of the opinion, right? Dimei avedes kechovim, biyadevat kechovim, mutarim, right? Because he felt, you know, that the money for the sale of idols, as long as it's still sold by idolaters, is okay. It's permitted, okay? And since before they became Gerim, they were still idolaters, so therefore he gave them permission to do what?
Sell
go sell the idols, whatever you have, and sell, you know, whatever is trade for the house, go sell that, and then you could use the money.
Yeah.
Then come back to the court, and you know, we'll take care of the conversion. Okay. So they say the deal, Moshani Hossam. No, maybe that case is not typical. It's different. The Kaven, the Date, the Geure, Vatai, Bitla says maybe, inasmuch as the Goy who is intending, you know, to become a Jew, since he knew that he had this intention, so maybe as long as he was still not yet converted, he went to the idol and he chipped off something of it. Remember, you know, in other words, he made the idol null and void. So it's no longer an idol, technically. Okay? Remember, we learned quite a few dumping back. I mean, that they chip it off, or you break it, or something about, you know, disfigure it, that shows you that you no longer have any confidence, any faith in the idol. Okay? So maybe this is what they did first. It wasn't mentioned, but maybe, he says, maybe this is what happened. Elamahocha. So, all right, let's take a different case. Yisrael shehoye doyshe be'evet kechavim mona v'mocha avedes kechavim. Alright, so we have a case of the Jew. He lent money to an idolater, okay, and now he wants his money back. Lent them money is 100 sous, okay.
Jew wants his money back.
Yeah, it sounds like he wants his money back, right. It's like a play of words in English and then the Hebrew text. money. Okay. So, what happened? So the guy sold his idol, right? Let's see, the guy sold his idols, right? The hay below. And what did he do? And he brought him the money that he got from the sale. Or maybe it was Yay Nesach, you know, wine that had been used for libations to the idolaters, right? So, and the hay below. And he brought him the money for it, right? Doesn't mean that he brought him the Yay Nesach, means that he brought him the money that he got from the sale of it. So, Mutter. So that's permissible. Avol, however, imamalo hamtein li achem karavet is kechovin v'yoli loch. But what if the idolater said to him, "You wait, I'm going to sell my avedah zarah, or I'll sell my yay nesach, and then I'll bring you the money." Then in that particular case, then it's no good.
What?
It's no good. It's awesome. Then in that case, it's forbidden.
Prohibited.
What does it look like? Looks like, in other words, he says to the Jew, "You wait, I'll take care of it, I'll sell it, and so forth, right? And then I'll bring in the money." So, it gives us the impression that the Jew, you know, is quite satisfied that the idol should be in existence until it is sold. We had that problem before, I mean, with the cask of wine, if you remember, right? Only there we said it was mutar, that it was permitted, right? But here we say that it is prohibited, because it seems like he wants very much, you know, that the guy, you know, he's willing to wait in order to get that money. And so it's as if he was encouraging him, you know, okay, whenever you get around to it, and so forth. Which is quite different from when the guy himself sold it, and then came to him and, you know, gave him the money.
I don't understand that. I don't understand.
All right.
He lends the guy money, okay?
He lent the guy money.
How does he expect it to get back?
He expects it to get back?
How,
he doesn't say how he expects to get it back. Obviously, the guys have to do something.
He has to sell something in order to get the money. That's his property. The guy
went ahead and he sold his idol. He sold his Yadnesach. And then he gave this money to the Jew. Is it permitted? We said, yes, it's permitted.
Yeah, because the Jew doesn't know.
Right.
Because he doesn't know.
The Jew did not tell him to do it. But here, it's as if the Jew is telling him, "Look, I'll wait. It's okay with me. The guy told him, wait, I'll do it. It's as if the Jew already gave consent, you know, to wait. And if he's giving consent, that means that he's giving consent that the idol should still be there, or that the Yainessel should be there, and so on, instead of having it destroyed immediately." Yes.
Yeah, it was a Yiddish expression. A cook and him to narrow frack fragile.
Is this the person who wanted to convert to Judaism?
No, this is a different case.
It's a
matter of the jewel.
In other words, if you're doing
and he wants it back. So, he gives it back to him without any explanation.
Right.
Even though he sold his idols or whatever, he can take it. But if the Jew tells him that that it's all right for me to wait if you go and sell your idols so you can give me the money, then that's not kosher.
Right. Exactly.
According to
that's exactly what the story is.
If you're doing business with a guy, you've got to be very careful of what you're asking him to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking about idol worship.
Right.
Because if you ask him
we're talking about idol worship, then
what he's giving you in return can be tainted.
Right.
Be a Vodazara.
That's correct.
Right.
Exactly. Okay, so they say Mishnah Reisha, Mishnah Sefer. What's the difference between case one and case two? You know, case one where he says he takes the money and it's okay, and then in case two he says wait until it's okay. So he says Omar Rav Sheshi. So Rav Sheshi says it's Sefer, it's Mishum Dehava Lei Kiyuetze B'Kiyuma. It's because, as I explained a few moments ago, it seems as if the Jew himself wants the idol to be in existence, or the Yaineser to be in existence, because he's willing to wait, But the Gemara immediately asks the question, no. And if he wants, he's willing to wait, as we explain over here, is it prohibited? Don't we have another Mishnah which deals with a case as follows? Ger v'yevit kechovim sheyoshu avihem. Okay. Na'avihem evit kechovim. Okay. You have two brothers, okay? One of them became converted to Yiddishkeit, right? And the other one remained an idolater, and the father, who was an idolater, passed away. Okay? This is the situation right now. So, the one who converted to Yiddishkeit can say to his brother, Tulato Avedas Kechavim Vadi Moos, you take the Avedas Zara, the idols, right? I'll take the money that dad left, right? Tulato Yay Nesach, you take the Yay Nesach, Vani Paris, and I'll take fruit. Okay? So far so good, right? So Im Mishabor Lewishus Hagir Osir. Alright, so we have to see the situation. Father died. Has the estate been transferred already to the two sons?
Has the estate of the father been transferred to the boys?
Right.
The sons?
Yeah.
Yes,
did they collect it or not? This is the question.
They inherited the possessions of their father.
Because we'll see now that when is he saying this to him and it's okay? If they didn't yet collect anything. So he says, okay, you take this, I'll take this. You take this, I'll take this.
They're
dividing up the estate, obviously. Okay? But if, on the other hand, but im shabor l'rishus hager, also, however, if the property came to the convert, then he is prohibited from using it.
For only for the son who converted.
No.
The idolater could have it, but the point is, could the son who converted, Yarshan, right, can he inherit, what the father had given to him if he already took possession of it? Then in that case, once he takes possession of the property together with his mother, they both take possession, then in that particular case, then he can't say to the brother, you take the Avodah Zarah and I'll take the money. Understand? You take the Yaidesa and I'll take the fruit. You can't do that anymore. This is what he's saying. It can only be done if they have not yet gone and collected the estate. But once he collects the estate, then in that particular case, it's as if he's also getting advantage, you know. In other words, the proceeds of the Avodah Zarah technically belong to him as well as to the brother.
Right,
so he can't use it. Omar Rav Barula, Ravun said, Masnisa Bavides Kechavim Hamischalekes Lefish Vareha. So he says, okay, the Mishnah actually is dealing with a case where the idol can be broken up into its parts. In other words, can be broken into its parts, and each part can be sold separately. Naturally, what kind of an idol are we talking about? Not talking about a clay idol. I mean, how are you going to get out of it? But let's say it was a golden idol. So each piece, if they break it up, still the gold is worth something. You see, right? Tinach avedus kechovim. Okay, we can understand, right? You know that an idol can be broken into its pieces. But yainesach ma'ikolim. How can such a situation exist with Yadessa? My equal, remember, what are you going to say? So he says, Becheres Hadriani. So they're talking about Hadrianic, I don't want to say porcelain, earthenware, Hadrianic earthenware. Now, what's this Hadrianic earthenware? There was a reference to it once before. At any rate, it seems that the Roman soldiers would put their wine in this type of a jug, which, you know, the clay that was used in order to, you know, to make the jug has certain special properties that it would absorb the wine. And then you would break it up into pieces, and you were able, you know, by immersing it in water, to get the wine out of it. So, you know, for a Roman soldier, he wanted a drink of wine while he was on a march or something like that. So this was a convenient way, you see, in order to get it. So he says, so if it were that kind, so there you can see that the Yainesuch also could be divided. Right. So in any way, the Hanor wrote to Mikiyamei Shalai Yigduvu, Shalai Yigdu. So, tell me, doesn't the Jew still want that, you know, the Yainesach or the idol should be in existence? Because he doesn't want them to be stolen. If they're stolen, they would be left without any guilt, right? So he would prefer, you know, to remain in existence, or that they should not get lost, right? So, Elam Rapapa, Yerusha Tagir Ka'amit. So Rav Papa says, all right, we're not talking now about an ordinary situation, we're talking about a special situation. What is a special situation? A special situation is the inheritance that a ger gets. The inheritance that a ger, not a parcel, you know, a convert to Yiddishkeit, gets. It's a special case. Why is it a special case? So he says, Shani Yerusha Saged Kidubur Rabbana. The case of the inheritance of a convert is a little different from the ordinary business of inheriting. The Kidubur Rabbana, because the rabbis were more lenient in this case. Now I have to explain what the situation is over here. You have, first of all, a ger, right, when he converts to Yiddishkeit, or a woman converts to Yiddishkeit, it's the same thing. I mean, it's as if they are born anew, okay? Like a baby. In other words, the past is wiped out and they start a brand new existence, okay? So, which means then that they no longer have technically a tie to their previous family. Well, I mean that they should spit in their face or anything like that, but, you know, the tie to their immediate family is broken. So if that's the case, why then should a convert even inherit from, and if, you know, the family tie has been broken? But nevertheless, the rabbis gave a more lenient interpretation of the law in this particular case. And, you know, they encouraged him to do what? They said, you know, go out, sell whatever you have beforehand, etc., etc., and then, you know, let them come in and become converted. Because, say, Gezeirah Shemiyasil Tukul, they were afraid that if they were too strict with him and said you can't have it or anything like that, then in that particular case, he would go right back again to becoming a goy. He'd cast aside all his Yiddishkeit and then become a goy again, because he figures the rabbis were too severe, too strict with him. So therefore, in this particular case, they felt that they had to give a more lenient interpretation. Yeah. Yes, now we go on to Samach Dalet, on the days. Okay. And the Gemara continues, and it says, Tanya Navi Hochi, we have learned likewise, Bamed Devar Mamurim, what kind of a case are we talking about? Sheyorshu. We're talking about where they inherit. Avol Nishtatfu, also. However, if the two brothers, the one who converted and the one who remained an idolater, go into partnership immediately, and what? Then they sell, let's say, an idol, you understand? Or sell Yayin Nesach, then in that case, it's prohibited to the convert in order to get that. Because in that particular case, I mean, we say, going into partnership, then the idol belongs to him and to you. Same thing with the Yayin Nesach. So therefore, that's why they said what they did. Hodu Yatsfu. Again, another time they were sitting, they called the Bayelhu, and they were schmoozing, halacha, right? And the question was raised as follows. Geir Toshav, Mahu, Sheyevate Lavidis Kechavit, the Folach. Mahu, Sheyevate Lavidis Kechavit. All right. Now we come to a different case. It's the case of the Geir Toshav. You see, a person who converts to Yiddishkeit, he's called a Ger Tzedek.
Ger what?
A Ger Tzedek.
Tzedek.
Right. In other words, he is a righteous,
convert.
Okay. And, you know, usually when we talk about a Ger, this is what we're talking about. However, the Bible uses the word Ger, and it also uses the word Ger V'Toshav. So Ger. The question is Ger V'Toshav.
Toshav.
Toshav. We in your today, Toshav, we translate as being, you know, like a citizen or something like that.
What?
But a citizen.
Yeah.
But, you know, Toshav is here because you recognize the root. The root is, of course, Yoshev. In other words, he dwells in your midst. He's not a Jew, but he's dwelling in your midst.
But he's not a convert either.
He's not a convert either, right. So this is what they're talking about now. Not the gear in the sense, you know, the convert to Yiddishkeit, but one who did not convert to Yiddishkeit, but he lives among Jews. Okay, it's a Ger Toshav. Now, obviously, if he's living among Jews, and we still call him a Ger, then it means, as we'll see from the Gemara over here, that he has forsworn some of his idolatrous practices. Okay? We had, historically, I have to tell you, at the time of the beginning of the Christian era, there were hundreds of thousands of people living in the Roman Empire who were called, they used the Greek term for them, Theos Ebobinai, which means Yirei Hashem, in other words, God-fearing people. Theos Ebobinai, this was the Greek term.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It means God-fearing people. They were attracted to Yiddishkeit, but they didn't want to go all the way into accepting, you know, everything that was part of Yiddishkeit. In other words, for example, they did not want to undergo circumcision. Okay? They didn't want to have a bris. But they felt, you know, that the idolatry that was rampant in the world was not for them. They did not believe in idolatry anymore. And so they wanted to worship, you know, the God of the Jewish people.
But without accepting,
exactly. Later, the Reform were born Jews, as far as I know, unless you're talking about their converts to Reform Judaism. Yeah, very large number. Someone estimated that if you would count them together with the Jewish population, they made up something like 1/10 of the population of the Roman Empire.
I don't hear you.
1/10. There was a fellow by the name of Rupin who was a sociologist, big man in one of the early founders of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And his field was sociology. So he estimated in his book on Jewish populations that at that particular time they made up about at least 10% of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire.
10%
Jews and sympathizers,
10%
yes.
10% of the Roman Empire?
The Roman Empire.
Wow. Jewish or Jewish sympathizers?
Jewish or Jewish sympathizers, right.
Yeah,
right.
Is that so, before Christianity
yeah,
came the,
right, right. Because you can see Christianity itself arose from an idea of the same thing. You know, within the Christians, you know, if you go into the history of Christianity, you know that the first Christians actually were Jews, except that they got this business, you know, that they believed that Yoshka was the Messiah.
Right.
But they continued to keep Shabbos and to practice Judaism and so on, which would include, of course, you know, the foods and the circumcision, etc., etc. But along came Paul. Maybe about 70, 80 years, 100 years or so after Yoshua,
right?
And he came up with a new theory. What is the theory? The theory is that you don't have to be a Jew in practice. You can be a Jew in spirit only. As a matter of fact, at times, you know, he even attacks those who want to practice Yiddishkeit, okay? So this became the selling point to the Romans, you know, that they are the true people of Israel without having to do anything. They could eat treif, they could do whatever they want, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, what was his argument on that?
His argument was that it's the spirit that counts and not the deeds.
I see.
That was his spirit. And the Protestants still follow this. Catholics supposedly also practice deeds, but the Protestants believe, you know, that faith, that's all that they need, faith. Deeds you don't need. Right? Well, since I've got some eyes, I don't have to tell you. I'm summarizing, you know, something that represents arguments going back and forth for the past 1,000 or 2,000 years or so. Right. Right.
Okay.
So, here we have now the Ger Toshav, right? As I said, he is a person, you know, who's living among Jews, And the question is, you know, what is expected of the Ger Toshav? So the first question is, Mahu Sheyivati Lovedis Kechavim, right? Does he have the ability to nullify an idol? Now, if you remember way back, we were talking about how you are Mevatel, how you, you know, the how you nullify it. You know, you say that the idol is no good, is no longer, and there were different ways that we said. But who has the ability to do it? The answer is not the Jew. A Jew cannot do it. Only the idolater himself can do it. This is what we learned, right? So now the question is, what about this Ger Toshav? He's living among Jews. Supposedly, he's a Jewish sympathizer, whatever he is. So, how do you count him? Does he still remain an idolater, and therefore he's able to nullify an idol, or not?
Right.
Exactly. Okay. So, the Gemara says, right, since they say, how about it? Yeah, what about him? Does he have this ability? So, the first opinion is, the falach mevatel, the lay falach le mevatel, right? If he actually worships an idol, then in that case, he has the ability to, you know, to nullify the idol, right? But if he no longer worships the idol, does he have the ability to do it? Say, lo mevatel, right? He can't do it anymore. Oh, Dilma, or maybe, call the one mine mevatel, the high bimenihu. Maybe we say, anyone like him, in other words, who's still not 100% Jewish, right, can still nullify the idol, and he's among those. I mean, like, as if he were an idolater. You understand?
In a business situation, then,
yeah,
the convert owns idols.
Right, right.
Not a convert.
No, we said that the Ger Toshav is not a convert. We're making a distinction between the Ger that we were talking about before, one who converted to Yiddishkeit, yeah, with the Ger Toshav who does not convert to Yiddishkeit, but he lives among Jews, and therefore he's subject to certain rules that contain, you know, to his behavior among Jews. That's the picture, right? So, as much as he is not converted to Yiddishkeit, 100%, right? So the question is, can he nullify? So first opinion is as long as he's still practicing idolatry, he can nullify. If he no longer practices idolatry, he has no ability to nullify. Or maybe, makes no difference whether he's still worshiping or not. As long as he's not Jewish, so he still has the ability to do it, even if he no longer practices idolatry himself. Why? Because we did learn that an idolater can not only nullify his own idol, but he can also nullify the idol of another idolater. That he can do. Okay? So that's the question. So Amaluhu Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman said to them, Bistabra, it makes sense, the Folach Mevatil, the Le Palach Le Mevatil, right? That if he still worships idols, then he can still nullify them. And if he doesn't worship, then he cannot do it anymore. Okay?
No.
That's what Rav Nachman says. Makes sense, he says. Right? So basically, so they ask Akasha based on something else that they have. It's come from Tosefta. It says, Yisrael Shemotza Vizke Kovim Mashruk. Okay. A Jew is walking along in the marketplace, right? And lo and behold, there's an idol over there. Okay? On the ground, obviously, you know. In other words, it's been dropped, abandoned, whatever. So he says, Ad shelo bos liyodei, rebelev yekocha, muvatla. As long as he himself is literally hasn't come into his own hands. In other words, as long as he hasn't picked it up and taking it, because then in that case it becomes his property. So as long as he hasn't touched it in any way, right? So he could say to an idolater, go and, you know, and nullify it, okay? But Mishabos the Yodor, however, if he picked it up, then he can no longer say to an idolater, go and nullify it. Because they said, an idolater can nullify the idol that belongs to him or to some other idolater. That he can do. Bain Oivda, whether he worships that particular idol, Bain Shein Oivda, or whether he doesn't worship that particular idol. No, 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 we're talking about a goy. The Jew tells the goy, go and nullify it, right? So the goy goes and he nullifies it, okay? Gone's fine. And it makes no difference, you know, whether it's the goy's own idol or whether it's the idol of some other goy. Okay? Because we learned that when it comes to nullification, a goy can nullify either his idol or somebody else's idol. Okay? So now they want a closer definition of my oivdo or my shein oivdo. What is the difference between someone who worships this and someone who doesn't worship this? So he says, Elema, if we mean as follows, Idi v'idi oivet kechavim, that either of them happen to be idols, hainu shalo v'shal chavero, and this is what we mean, and his idol and his, and another guy's idol, right? El alav, Oivdo Evid Kechavim, right? But rather we're talking about an idolater who, you know, worships an idol. Umay She'eino Evdo, so if that's the case, so what kind of a goy, you know, doesn't worship an idol? So we would say Ger Toshav, right? So we're talking about a Ger Toshav. He's still an idolater in the sense that he doesn't worship anymore, but still he hasn't converted to Yiddishkeit yet, right? And from this we learn that what? Ger Toshav Namim Mevatel, right? That the Ger Toshav also still has the ability to nullify, because as long as he's not Jewish, even though he personally doesn't worship idols anymore, but he can still do it, right? So they say, lo, no, 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 that's not what we mean. He says, le'olam emelecho, in truth, what I'm saying to you is, idi v'idi oivet kechavim, right? Both they are idolaters, utka amrit, haynu shelo v'shel chavero. When I say to you, you know, his own or the other one, so he says, Reisha Zeveze Lifar, Zeveze Lamakulis, right? In the first case, we mean that, for example, both of them, Zeveze, each one, they all observe, they all worship the same idol. And they mention to one of them, Peor, which of course is mentioned in the Torah, Parsha Bullock, right, which we'll be reading about this Shabbos. And the other one is Marculus, which we had before, if you remember, you know, the statue of the Mercury that they piled stones up on, if you remember, right? The Mercury, Marculus. Remember, they piled stones. Maybe you, I don't remember whether you were here at that time, it may have been at the time when you were ill. You know.
Mercury.
Right, but Marcos is really Mercury, okay? So, Seifa, but in the latter case, Zelif, or one idolater, worships Peor, Vizel the Marcolis, and the other one worships Marcolis. In other words, two different idols. Each, you know, instead of both of them worshiping the same, but each one has a different one. And still, what? Still the question is, can, let's say, the person, the idolater who worships Mercury, can he be Mevatel Peor? You understand? Or can the person who worships Peor, can he be Mevatel Marcolis? So this is why we say whether it makes no difference whether he observes, whether he worships, or he doesn't worship. In other words, even though they don't worship the same idol, but nevertheless, they could not only be Mevatel their own idol, but also the other idol. So, Maishpeh, now they ask the following question. Ezehu Ger Toshav. How do you define a Ger Toshav? When does he become a Ger Toshav? So it says, Kol Shekibir Lalov Bifnei Gimel Chavim Shadu La'avod Aviz Kechavim. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says, A Ger Toshav becomes that when he goes before three scholars. Chavir over here doesn't mean friends, but it means scholars, right? And he makes a declaration that he will no longer worship idolatry. This is Rabbi Meir's opinion. The Chachamim Emrim, and the sages say, oh, that's not enough, he says. Kol Shev Kibir Lalov Sheva Mitzvah Shev Kibir Lalehem B'nei Noach. In order to be a Ger Toshav, they have to take upon themselves to observe the seven mitzvahs that were given to the descendants of Noach. You know, yes.
You know, there was a movement, I saw an article recently about a group of people who identify with these seven.
Right.
You know, and they
call themselves, but they know Noach, Noah eyes or something like that, right? Yes.
Where's that article?
Yeah, there's been a movement among some of the Protestant sects to observe this. Right,
earlier,
yeah.
10% of the Roman Empire?
Yeah, like that. I mean, it would be similar, right, of that nature, right. I mean, these were commandments such as, you know, not to murder, not to steal, not to commit adultery.
Not to tear a limb.
Right, not to have a baby Achai, as we say, exactly right. Right, seven misses for they Noah, right. Yeah. Because you take a look, you know. Yeah, when the descendants of Noah, you know, came forth from the ark, right? So you take a look and say for Bereshit over there in Parsha Noah, you'll see that there are different commandments given at that particular point. So this is the basis of the Sheva Mitzvahs.
So what you're saying here now is if the Ger takes that oath to observe those seven...
Right. That makes him a Ger Toshav. A Ger Toshav. It's not a Ger Toshav. Right. Not a convert to Yiddishkeit yet. No. But this is what he undertakes to do. Right.
Another category.
Right. Okay. So, as you notice, Rabbi Meir says the first thing is give up idolatry. But, the first one, Shado Lavod Aved is Kechavim, right? This is what he said, not to worship an idol anymore. Okay. And this is Rabbi Meir's opinion, but the Chachomim say that in addition, he has to take upon himself the other mitzvahs B'nei Noach, besides. You know, not to kill, not to steal, not to commit adultery, to set up courts of law. That's also an important thing. I mean, right? Yeah. So these are the things. Okay.
Right.
And then there are those who say, Eilu lebo dechlal ger toshav. That's not enough, according to some others, they say. That still doesn't make him a real ger toshav. Eilu ezu ger toshav. But what, in their opinion? is a real Ger Teshuv, right? So it says, Ze Ger Oichel Nezeles, Shekibel Olov Zekayim, Kol Mitzvus Habus, Batoya Chutz, Be Isur Nezeles. This is a person who says, I will observe everything in the Torah except the Treif. Except the Treif. I'll eat Treif. So, according to our Harib, all right, so he's also a Ger Teshuv. He's so he can continue to eat Treif, but he's a Ger Teshuv.
Reformed Jew.
I think on that happy note we'll stop tonight's shiur and continue with this next week. So tonight is the 11th of July and we are continuing now in the Gemara of Edizora, Daf Samach Dalad, Omid Beis, that's 64b. Okay, and we continue from where we left off. Now we're not finished yet with the business of the Ger Toshav. Oh, remember that the Ger Toshav, remember, is a person who is still not Jewish. He has not converted 100%. To what extent, you know, should he convert? I mean, should he accept Yiddishkeit? So this we saw, there were three different opinions mentioned. First, the opinion of Rabbi Meir, that if he says, I refuse any longer, you know, to be an idol worshiper, so that's enough already to qualify him as a Ger Toshav. And by the way, the Ger Toshav technically is somebody who's living in Eretz Israel, a non-Jew living in Eretz Israel. That's technically, okay? The second one that we saw, the Chachomim, they said that they have to accept the Sheva Mitzvos of Neinach and they should do it in the presence of a Beis Din to make it official that they're going to observe that, okay? Now, of course, among the Sheva Mitzvos of Neinach, one of them is against idolatry. But as we saw, it also includes, you know, not to murder, not to steal, to maintain courts of law, not to eat a neva min l'chai, in other words, to tear a limb off a living animal and eat that, it's also prohibited, and so on. So whatever we find in the Sefer Bereishis and Parsha Noach that was prohibited over there, this is what they have to observe. And then the third one, Achirim, says that all that is not enough, but they have to agree to observe all the mitzvahs of the Torah except that they don't have to eat kosher. Why not? Well, the reason for that is because there is a pasuk in the Torah which says that if you have an animal that becomes a nevela, okay? What's a nevela? Nevela technically is an animal that the shechita was not right. Right? So, in that particular case, it is prohibited for a Jew. So, what to do with the nevela? The answer is, Lager asher bishorecho titneno va'achola. It's what the Torah says. In other words, to the stranger within your gates, you shall give it so that he can eat. In other words, you have to give sustenance, you have to give food to the ger. So now this is now the point that we're going to have.
Sorry, one more question before we go.
Right.
And that is if they do everything including the kashrus.
Yes.
Do they then become a Ger Tzedek?
A Ger Tzedek? If they convert officially, right.
Which would include doing
the
mitzvahs. That includes everything.
Everything, right, exactly.
They do keep kosher.
Yeah, exactly.
But they also have the other, isn't there the proviso that they must also, the second one, they must go into the mikveh?
Yes, all right, that's already, of course.
That there was that.
In order to, you're absolutely right. It's not mentioned that this applies to a Ger Toshav. But
no.
If you want to be a Ger Tzedek, then definitely the mikveh for both male and female converts.
Right.
And of course, for a male convert, in addition, he has to be circumcised.
Yeah.
Right. So these are the, you know, the sine qua non, right? Yeah. Okay. So now the Gemara continues.
What line are we in?
Okay.
We are.
Huspius and Avelis. It begins with the word Miyachadin. Do you see that?
Yes, sir.
Miyachadin. Huh? Yeah. Samach Dalet Omid Beis. Omid Beis. Hey, listen, you haven't been around a couple of weeks. Okay. All right. So. It says, okay, Miyachad in Eslo Yayin, V'yein Mafkid in Eslo Yayin. Okay. It's roughly about two-thirds of the way down on the page, okay? Which means that with a Ger Toshav, remember again, he's not a Jew. He's still a Goy, okay? So the question is, what can you have wine with him? You understand? The problem naturally is, what do we say? Goy, who is, he observes, you know, idolatry, there's no question that the wine becomes a nesel, period. That's all there is to it. We can't use it, okay? Or we cannot even get any hanor from it. We cannot profit from it anyway. So, but what about in the case of the Ger Toshav? Is it permitted, for example, to leave wine with him with the expectation that he's not going to touch the wine, and thereby he's not going to make it into Yein Nesef, make it impossible for a Jew to drink or to have hador from it? This is the question. So, we say that Miyachadin Eslo Yayin, which means that we can leave him alone with wine for a short while. You heard of the word yichud. What's yichud? Yeah, like for example, chassid and kala get together, right? So they go into the yichud room where they are together. Okay. Or we know that a strange man and a strange woman, right, should not be together, right? That's also called yichud. Okay. Right. That's also called yichud. Okay. So, the wine can be left with him for this short period of time. They don't specify exactly how long, right? But the Ein Mafkidin Eslo Yayin. However, you don't put wine over there literally as a deposit. In other words, you know, to have him keep it in his house or something like that, in his room, for a longer period of time. Was a mafkid is somebody who leaves something, he entrusts it to somebody else to wash it for him. So we see already that while they're a little bit liberal in that they say for a short while you can trust them, but you cannot do it on a regular basis. What is the fear? The fear is that he may decide that if it's there for a long time, either he'll help himself to it, or maybe he'll decide that this wine is better than his own wine, and so he'll mix up the barrels or something or other like that. So that's why they don't trust him 100%. Okay. And they say, Va'afilu bi'ish harubu Yisrael, even if this Ger Toshav lives in a city where the majority of the inhabitants are Jewish. Remember we had before, quite a few pages back, that, you know, if you can look through the window, you pass by an open door and so on and so forth and so on, so then you can see whether men shepherd or we don't shepherd, you understand, right? Whether somebody is guilty of, you know, touching the wine and so on and so forth. So, and we said, you know, that if the Irish will be a swirl, you know, you have a lot of Jews who are back and forth on the street and so on, so you can rely upon the fact that they're always keeping an eye out on this particular store where the wine is in order to make sure nothing happens. But here it says, even in a city where the majority of the inhabitants are Jews, still you don't leave it with him for any long period of time. Then And even right? But we can leave it for we can leave it just for a short time with him. Afilo, even if it's in a city where the majority of the inhabitants are idolaters, because we figure that he is not going to do anything in a short period of time in order to, be distrusted by the Jew who left it with him. Because he figures the Jew is going to be back any moment, he doesn't know when, and therefore he's not going to touch it. Then it says, Shamno Kiyeno, which means literally, the oil of this person is like the wine of this person. Meaning what? I don't know if you remember, at one time we learned that the Beis Din wanted to outlaw the shemen, the olive oil of the Ivikechavim. Eventually, that fell by the wayside, if you remember, because later Beis Din came along and they decided that oil was not being used for Avodah Zarah. Yes?
But oil would not be used sacramentally, like wine might be.
Right, right. So although actually in the Beis HaMikdash, oil was a necessary ingredient. That's the point. It still was.
Even in burning?
Right. But they felt, that oil that was used for ordinary purposes or something like that, they felt that there was no issur involved in it. But this was not the universal feeling of everybody, because as we saw, originally what they wanted to do was to ban that, just as they banned Yad Nesach.
But the only
thing.
Place the oil was used sacramentally was in the Beis
HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash was used, right.
But wine was used throughout the population.
Right, right. Of course, I'm not thinking only, let's say, the use of oil in the Beis HaMikdash for lighting the lamps. I mean, that we commemorate with Hanukkah and everything else. But actually, in making the meal offering, the mincha, as we call it, you have to mix flour with oil. Right. Right.
In other words, what you're saying, the wine and the oil treated.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about what the Kohanim would do with the oil, not what the Yehudim
would do. Yeah, well, correct. But the point is, on a commercial basis, could a Jew buy olive oil from a goy? You understand? That's the question.
Did they already rule on that?
Yes, they did.
They said it was okay. Yeah.
But there were those who, prior to the Beis Din coming out and saying it's okay, then they felt that it should be prohibited just as much as Yad Nesach was. So this is what they're saying. Shamno Kiyeno, right? Which would represent the view of those who say that the olive oil is to be treated the same way as the wine. In other words, can you leave olive oil for a few moments with the Ger Toshav? Yes. Can you leave it for an extended amount of time? The answer is no. So, at this moment, they say, Shabdo Kiyedu Salkodate. What are you talking about that his oil is just like his wine? Sheven Miko Havi Yedesach. Since when is oil Yain Nesach? It's not the same. So, Elo Yeno Keshavna. But we have to say that the wine that we're talking about over here is like the olive oil. In other words, just as you can trust them for a few moments with the olive oil, so you can trust them for a few moments with the wine. This is the point that they're making. Okay? Okay, the shor called Dover, but when it comes to other things, Harehu Kevet Kechovim, he still is a goy, and therefore in other areas, you know, he's still treated as a non-Jew, as an idolater. Okay? So, the question is, L'may Hilchasa, in respect to what halacha, is this true? So they say, D'mevatil avedas kechovim, ki oved kechovim. So one statement is that, just as we learned, how can an oved kechovim be mevatil his idol? So what we learned, he breaks it, he chips off something from it, right? And so on and so forth. Whatever he does in order to disfigure it, to show that he no longer believes in it. Okay? So likewise, and we also said what? A Jew cannot be mevatel avedus kechovim, right? So how about this person? Is he a Jew or is he still a non-Jew? So they say, the halacha is that he's like a non-Jew yet at this particular point, even though he himself doesn't practice idolatry, because that he had to give up, if you remember, right? So even though he doesn't practice idolatry, but nevertheless, he does have the ability to annul the avodah.
Are we talking, in effect, of something like a citizenship?
Yes.
He gets the citizenship to be part of the land of Israel, correct. But he doesn't have the standing within the Judaic law.
Right, absolutely. And we find the Torah, there are different things that say lagir, the toshav haaretz, right? Lagir, in other words, for the sake of the, which we interpret in the English translation is for the stranger. But it doesn't really give justice to the Jewish concept behind it. According to the Jewish concept, who is the ger? The ger over here is the ger tzedek, right? And then the toshav for oretz, that would be the other one, the ger toshav. You understand?
Yeah.
So the ger is the one who's 100% Jewish, because he's been converted to Yiddishkeit, or she's been converted to Yiddishkeit. Okay, but the toshav for oretz, they've given up idolatrous practices. They may even have adopted some Jewish practices, but they're not 100% totally committed yet. So as long as they're not totally committed to Yiddishkeit, and in that particular case, they are still goyim. So it says, k'oved kachavim, right? Like as if he were in this particular halacha. Okay?
So I have another question.
Yeah.